JSA in the 90s. This episode, a spotlight on the Vigilante miniseries from 1995. Hello, and welcome to JSA in the 90s, a podcast dedicated to the Justice Society of America and related characters as published in the 1990s. We are a proud member of the Fire and Water Podcast Network. My name's the Irredeemable Shang, and I'm your host, but I'm not a lone cowboy. Every single episode, we feature a different guest host. My guest today has devoted an entire podcast to one character. Not Batman, not Spider-Man, not even Booster Gold. Nope, Greg Saunders, the Golden Age Vigilante. That's the kind of commitment that either earns you a Lifetime Achievement Award or a wellness check. This Vigilante superfan wears multiple cowboy hats. That of a podcaster, a voice actor, a historian, and an unofficial public relations department. If you've ever wanted to hear someone make the Golden Age Vigilante sound like one of the cooler heroes in comics, my guest today is your guy. Folks, please help me welcome Ranger Gord. Welcome to the JSA Brownstone, Ranger Gord. Thanks for being here, man. How you doing?
Well, howdy. How are you? How's everything down there in Florida?
It's going well. I got to tell you, I have been trying to learn how to spin a lasso all week getting ready for this, and I have failed miserably. Any pointers you can give me?
Oh, yeah. You got to hold the Honda with three fingers and then point your index into the loop and then just swing it above your head and then do that on a horse while a calf is moving. No problem.
That sounds really easy if I knew what most of those words meant, and I don't. So, okay. Fair enough.
Well, we got to get you up here into Alberta and show you how to talk here.
Well, folks, we're very excited here. We are going to be talking about the Vigilante miniseries from 1995, Vigilante City Lights, Prairie Justice. It was a miniseries written by James Robinson. And, you know, back in the 90s, he was the writer, basically. He was the architect of JSA-related stuff going on with the Golden Age, Starman, JSA, all that. So it really fits in our wheelhouse because Vigilante, I mean, no, he was not part of the JSA, but he's JSA adjacent. You know, he's a fellow Golden Age character. He's part of the Seven Soldiers of Victory. He's part of the All-Star Squadron. So he's part of our family. This episode is also part of the social media movement Western Comics Month. Folks across the internet are reading Western comics in July and posting about it on social media. And Gord here actually suggested we cover this topic. Gord's one of our big supporters on Patreon, and he suggested it. And so this is a Patreon-fueled episode, folks. So we're really looking forward to talking about this.
Yeah, even before I joined the Gravy and Lava podcast network there, I remember one time, and I don't even remember the context. It might have been one of your Who's Who shows. I believe it was probably the one of the loose leaf ones where you were talking about the El Diablo appearance.
Oh, yeah.
And I remember you were talking and said, yeah, we got to do a whole show on that. And I'm just typing away furiously. And I goes, hey, only one man in the world can't hear this song. And it's you guys. Hey, yes, I want to do this. Of course, I hadn't podcasted yet. So I'm glad you waited until I got some sand under my saddle.
I was going to say you had some sand under your horse's hooves, but here you go. That works. That works. And well, I'm thrilled to be doing this with you. And you know, I was looking at this. This is kind of interesting. This is actually the first comic book series entitled Vigilante that actually features Greg Saunders. Because prior to this, he was just guest starring stuff, right?
He's never had a single issue with his eponymous, with his name upon it. Everything else has been co-opted by that character with the ski mask that isn't even a Canadian.
Well, folks, I'm really excited about this next thing. We actually have a special treat. So as the Greg Saunders superfan, I know, Gord, you have an appreciation for troubadours. And folks, this is the big announcement here is Ranger Gord is ready to serenade us with one of his own troubadour tongs. So take it away, Ranger Gord.
I am? Well, okay.
I just assumed, I mean, as a troubadour, you'd be ready for this.
Let me just think. You know what? I'm going to sing one of my fellow Albertans who actually lived in the same town. In fact, his dad was our ranch veterinarian, and his name was Cor Blund. And Cor Blund is a recording artist, usually in not so much country music, but the Americana folk side of it. So this is one of my favorite songs of his.
All right.
Well, I want to be in the cavalry if they send me off to war. I want a good steed under me like my forefathers before. I want a good mount when the bugle sounds and I hear the cannons roar. Well, I want to be in the cavalry if they send me off to war. Well, I want a horse in the volunteer force that's riding forth at dawn. Please save for me some gallantry that will echo when I'm gone. And I beg of you, Sarge, let me lead the charge when the battle lines are drawn. Let me at least have a good hoofbeat when they'll remember loud and long. I'm not a good foot soldier, mate. I'd be sour and slow at march. And I'd be sick on a Navy ship and the sea would leave me parched. But I'll be first in line if they let me ride. By God, you'll see my starch. Lope back o'er the heath with a laurel wreath underneath that victory arch. And I think I'm not going to do the album version.
Wow! Folks, let me tell you, when I threw that bit in about making Gord sing, it was a joke. I had no idea he'd be prepared. That was amazing. In fact, you know, some people are now going to accuse us of jumping the shark because we just did our first musical episode, right? But that was amazing, Gord. Thank you so much.
Well, I didn't go further with it because I don't think yodeling on a headset would come over very well.
Well, I'm floored because nobody else has done like a troubadour style singing on any of my JSA shows. So this is really a special occasion. So the next guest has got big shoes to fill. I'm just saying.
Boots,
right? Yes. Okay. Well, before Gord sings us his entire hymnal there, we should probably take a second to thank our sponsors. Folks, this episode of JSA in the 90s is sponsored in part by InStockTrades.com. InStockTrades is your best online source for trades, hardcovers, and other collected editions, all for up to 42% off with free shipping for orders of $50 or more. Now, each episode, we select a collected edition to briefly discuss from the InStock Trades library, and usually it's tied into this month's JSA issue in some way, shape, or form. I picked JSA The Golden Age Trade Paperback, the 2024 edition. Primarily, I mean, it's a no-brainer. It's James Robinson writing both the story we're covering today and this. It came out the same year as Vigilante, and this is the amazing four-issue miniseries called The Golden Age by James Robinson. Amazing art by Paul Smith. It is gorgeous. It's a 200-page count, full color, soft cover. Normally goes for $24.99. It's 40% off right now, so you can get it for $14.99. And I'm telling you, folks, if you haven't read it, first, avoid spoilers online, please, because there's some great surprises in there. And it is one of the greatest JSA Elseworlds stories. And it's almost not an Elseworlds. It's darn close to not being. But either way, it's phenomenal. It is absolutely great. Now, Gord, I gotta ask you, I mean, all the cool kids bringing in stock trades pick, I mean, you're already super cool because you sang a song. So maybe I'll let you off the hook if you didn't. But did you happen to bring an InStock Trades pick?
Well, I'd like to tell you that InStock Trades, who I have purchased from before, even though we're across the borders and that's a little complicated, I'd like to tell you that they have the Vigilante graphic novel that I have read this story from, Vigilante City Lights Prairie Justice. However, they don't.
Hey, don't fault them. That's DC Comics' fault for not keeping it in print.
Exactly. But you know what? I have a ringer here. So I'd like to tell you about the DC Finest Collection and Westerns, The Hangman Never Loses. Well, we've got this anthology of Western tales from the Bronze Age, journey back to the Old West where fast wits and a fast draw were the only way to survive, and to follow heroes like Hawk, Firehair, the original El Diablo, and more as they try to bring some semblance of justice to the lawless frontier. DC's Finest Western, The Hangman Never Loses, is chock full of classic frontier adventure by some of comics' greatest creators, including Robert Kaniger, John Abano, Gil Kane, Joe Kubert, Tony DeZeninga, and others. So it's all collecting all-star Westerns and weird Westerns and all sorts of good things from Tomahawk. And on the list price was $39.99. You get it for $23.19 US. You save 42%. I won't go into the Canadian conversion because that gets real complicated.
Well, that's fantastic. Those collected editions that DC are doing right now, those are amazing. They're gorgeous books. That's a great pick. So nicely done. Thank you. So you've come through twice now. I'm telling you, you're a ringer. You're doing amazing.
Okay, I can quit now.
Yeah, sure. Bye. Thanks. Thanks for coming.
All right. Adios.
Well, folks, for these and all your other trade paperback needs, please visit InStockTrades.com. Now, this episode is also sponsored in part with your Patreon support, because, you know, running the Firewater Podcast Network with so many shows requires a lot of online hosting and other services, and a while back, we realized we needed some help with the expenses. So we launched a Patreon, and you folks really stepped up to help keep the network going. So if you're enjoying the JSA in the 90s podcast, the best way to support the show is by visiting our Patreon, which is patreon.com/FWPodcast. While you're there, please consider supporting the network. Network. And in certain tiers, you get mentioned on your show of choice, just like these folks who asked to be recognized specifically on the Justice Society Presents podcast. Our thanks go out to this all-star squadron of supporters. Al the Comics Guy, Alex Osias, Bill Beer, Bruno Diaz, Chris Mort, Craig Fletcher, David Ace Gutierrez, DC Dave, Devin Clancy, George Van Note, Jason Keane, Jeffrey Owens, Jordan Jennings, Keechee Baker, Kevin Wetter, Mark Baker Wright, Matt Ev, Michael Bailey, Michael Crouch, Mike Atchison, Mike Zamkowski, Roger Preed, Little Russell Burbage, Symbol Pending, Ted Kilvington, Tim Price, and some weirdo named Ranger Gord.
Yahoo!
Again, folks, please visit our Patreon at patreon.com/FW podcast. I love that you have all these cowboy sounds and noises that you make. They're such a fun trademark. That's awesome.
Well, most people don't even know how I talk regular anymore. So.
Well, folks, get out on the social media and find us as JSA Presents. I want you guys to interact with us because I always say it's about building a community of online JSA fans around the show. And be sure to go out to our website, fireandwaterpodcast.com, and leave your comments on the show post. Now, Ranger, this is your moment. This is your chance to tell us your personal origin story with Vigilante. You know, how'd you discover the character? What made you fall in love with him? Why did you choose him to start your own podcast, Prairie Justice, the Greg Saunders Vigilante Podcast?
I was waiting for that.
You knew it was going to happen. I'm practically a co-star on some of your episodes when you soundbite me saying it over and over and over.
Yeah. Well, royalties will be in. Picture it. Tabor, Alberta, 1972. Well, Little Ranger heads to the drugstore. Said I'm a drugstore cowboy, of course. While my mom is shopping for groceries while we're in town, and I'm going to do my normal pulls, and I have on a mission. I have learned of the Justice Society the previous year and learned of something called Earth 2. And I have learned that, in the summers, the Justice Society appears every year in JLA. And lo and behold, they open their X-All door, and there it is, JLA 100. And there's some superheroes I know, and then there's some superheroes I don't know. And over top of a Greyhound is some superheroes I definitely don't know. Well, there looks like a cowboy and a King Arthur and a couple of Robin Hood types and some kind of a bargain basement Captain America kid.
Oh,
well, that thing's going to my car, or my mom's car, I should say. Because back in those days, she'd give you the keys to the car because you're going to sit in there and read comics. Well, I opened that thing up, and, you know, I've heard Rob talk about JLA 200. Well, JLA 100 was my JLA 200. You open that up, and yes, I got some of the JLA heroes that I knew, and I went, what? There's a new Wonder Woman, and she wears a white pantsuit? There's this stretchy guy that's running around with the Flash. What's a metamorpho? I don't know what a metamorpho is. And then you turn the pages, there's a guy that looks like Batman, but it's not Batman, and they're calling him Wildcat, and some guy in a gas mask. All of these characters are new, and I keep wondering about this fabulous guy named Johnny Thunder, but keep turning the pages because it's going to get better, because those guys from the grave site are going to show up, and they are called the Seven Soldiers of Victory. Which even then, you know, even little 9-year-old Gord could count and realize there was 8. That's okay. We will never correct that historical error from 1941. But yeah, and for some reason, the cowboy got me. Because this isn't like a Texas Twister or a Knight Rider sort of a situation. This guy isn't wearing a costume. And his guns don't shoot laser beams. And he's got an actual rope like I fool around with at home. Or out in the corrals, you know, out where we live. And I'm going, well, this is strange. He's wearing boots like everybody I know wears. He was wearing a hat like everybody I know wears. What's so weird about this guy? And, of course, this is a fish-out-of-water character that plays in the world of superheroes. He's got no powers, has never exhibited any powers, at least until Grant Morrison came along. And he just exists with his own wits. I knew enough about roping and rodeo to know that that's a real skill. And I went, well, that's what he does. And, of course, the six guns are amazing because, you know, I'm my father's son. I'm addicted to the John Waynes and the Clint Eastwoods and everything else. And I went, wow, this is amazing. They put a real character up. And he actually was from a real-life ranch. He's from Wyoming. He's from two states away. I could go visit him. anyway, he very much appealed to me. And it seemed that summer there was a real renaissance of vigilante kicking around. He was over in Adventure Comics, drawn by the amazing Gray Morrow, who was incredibly realistic and just drew him right off of the pages of a Western magazine or something like that. And there was some Wanted reprints and World's Finest reprints and things like that that had the great Mort Meskin stuff. And learned out he had a little Chinese-American sidekick. The name is Stuff. I still think that's a weird thing to call him. He's a great character, though. As I've done this podcast and indexed him, I just like Stuff so much more as a sidekick than more than Robins or Buckies or anything else, because the kid's real. He's got a smart mouth. He's not as scared of anything. He's intelligent. Half the Avengers vigilante gets into because Stuff is reading the newspaper and finds out something going on. And I went, how many sidekicks read the newspaper?
Right.
Anyway, Stuff is going to be, of course, a part of the thing that we're going to talk about. But I just love the whole zeitgeist of him. And I was amazed to find out years later how long he had lasted in the 1940s. And then just disappeared like so many characters of the Golden Age, and then came back for that 1970s renaissance. And there's always a lot of talk about A-list heroes and B-list heroes, and I don't even want to talk about what Vig is. I guess he's a V-list. just because you can almost list all of his appearances in comics on two sides of a sheet of paper. But every time he comes up, you never hear anybody complaining about it. Everybody talks about how cool he is. And I think it's that, well, sorry, Rob, fish out of water situation. He's just always in over his head. This guy jumps in just like the two-gun kid. He time travels. He goes into old fairy lands and learns how to overcome magic, especially in the Seven Soldiers of Victory. And these guys just, like, along with the soldiers, they're always over their head. They're always risking, and they always come out ahead using their brains as much as their weapons. So that's kind of Vig for me. And of course, you know, like I said, coming from a country sort of experience, he talked to me.
That's fantastic. I mean, that's a wonderful way. A lot of us just like a character because we like a character. You saw a connection in your youth and you're in the people around you in that. That's fantastic. For me, and thanks for asking, by the way, I probably ran into him first in like Crisis on Infinite Earths is probably where I saw him first. Then immediately from there, I would have read Who's Who with his entry and saw him in All-Star Squadron, Young All-Stars, and a few Seven Soldiers appearances here and there. But I didn't really get a chance to focus on. I mean, I'm sure I bought those reprints you mentioned, like the reprints from the 70s. I'm sure I bought some of those as well. But I didn't really stand up and take notice of them until that Justice League Unlimited episode, where they did sort of a Seven Soldiers of Victory kind of thing with Stargirl and I believe Green Arrow. It was basically all the non-powered characters fighting the General, I think it was. And he just really got my attention to that. I'm like, this guy is cool. And I don't know, it's because I saw the animation is what made it stand out, but he just, the bravery, the willingness to just jump in, that awesome motorcycle, I just loved everything about him. So I still haven't really dug in and done much with the character, but it's a character that I've enjoyed seeing. And when he shows up, I'm like, oh, cool. So when we got to read this miniseries, I was like, okay, this will be fun. I'm looking forward to it.
Well, Chris and Cindy, of course, did, well, the entire JLA series, and yep. I guess guested on a couple of the podcasts where Vig appeared. And he comes across as not too good in one because he's very dismissive and a little bit, well, as Cindy would say, more than a little bit sexist toward Talk Girl. And I don't think it was so much sexism as he just didn't trust her. And then he comes across so much better in that the unofficial Seven Soldiers episode. It's kind of neat how the show itself very much underestimates him when he shows up and the kids are going, who cares about some dumb cowboy? And I'm just going, and somebody else is saying, well, vigilantes, that probably isn't a good. But he kind of takes over the parade. He becomes the public relations guy. He leans in on his musical and entertainment experience. And then he sort of becomes a leadership. Now, even though Shining Knight is the star of that battle, Vig very much takes over as in the leadership role in trying to bring down General Wade Eiling.
And by the end, aren't the kids playing pretend being the vigilante, if I remember right?
Oh, yeah. By the end, the Newsboy Legion stand-ins there, who I think are the Newsboy Legion. Yeah, suddenly they're hero-worshipping Mr. Saunders.
Yeah, that's awesome. Well, folks, if you're not terribly familiar with the vigilante, I'm going to do a real quick bio on him. But understand that if you really want a deeper dive on this, again, you've got to listen to Ranger Gord's podcast. I'll say the name for you one more time, Gord, just to make you happy. Prairie Joe. Justice, the Greg Saunders Vigilante Podcast.
Yeehaw!
So, Vig, as we're calling him, was created by Mort Weisinger and Mort Meskin in 1941 for Action Comics number 42. So, Action Comics, there was another guy in that book you might have heard of that dressed in different clothes. You might have read some of those. Anyway, Greg Saunders was one of the singing cowboys of the era, right? And, you know, that's what he did during the day. And then otherwise, he would also wear the mask during the 1940s as a member of the Seven Soldiers of Victory. You mentioned Stuff, right? As they called him, the Chinatown Kid, as his sidekick. He did have two other sidekicks at different points, Billy Gunn, and then a second Stuff as a sidekick. And you mentioned that story, issue 100, where him and the other Seven Soldiers of Victory were thrown through time in a battle with the Nebula Man, and Vigilante ends up being thrown into the Old West for two decades before he's rescued. Now, you also mentioned earlier the number of comics he appeared in. I had no idea. I did a little research before we got started here. I was shocked to find out from 1941 to 1954, he appeared in about 175 comic books. That is wild. And most of those were Action Comics, in fact. So, I mean, there were a ton of kids out there who were reading Superman, who absolutely knew who the Vigilante was. And didn't he, now, this is off the top of my head, didn't he have like a movie serial or a movie of some sort too?
He had a 12-part movie serial in 1947, The Vigilante Rides Again, played by Ralph Byrd. And, of course, that came out a year before Superman got a serial.
Ah, okay.
Yeah, so who's the warm-up knack now here, Mr. Kent?
That's fantastic. That's awesome. Well, and you already mentioned the El Diablo. I want to mention that, too, because, you know, normally when we do the Spotlight episodes, we talk about other appearances in the 1990s. There's really only one significant appearance of the Vigilante. I mean, he appeared in a couple other comics, but as far as significant appearances in the 1990s, it was that El Diablo, number 12. And in that, Greg Saunders, he's an older man at that point, and he has plans to open a new restaurant, his Western-themed chain called The Last Roundup. He's going to open it in Dos Rios, but really he's there to check out the new masked hero on the block, the modern El Diablo, to make sure he's handling those Vigilante duties well. And kind of a nice connection with this podcast, it's drawn by Mike Parabek. So again, check out El Diablo number 12. But right now, we're going to get into this miniseries, Vigilante, City Lights, Prairie Justice. Now, folks, we're going to post...
What was that? What did you say there? Lights?
I got to say it right? Okay. Vigilante, City Lights, Prairie Justice.
Oh, it's just like a rhapsody onto the plains.
Now, folks, surprisingly, this is not on DC Infinite. So you're going to have to find either the individual issues or you're going to have to get the collected edition out there. But it's worth it. So seek it out. But I will share a few of the images out on our website, which is FireWaterPodcast.com. They'll have a gallery post out there so you can see some of the images from here, because it, believe me, it's worthwhile. There's some interesting art in here. It's published by DC Comics. Cover date is November 1995 through February 1996. It was on the shelves September 1995 through December 1995. The cover price is $2.50 per issue. Now, that's $10 for the whole miniseries, or 40 shiny quarters to get the whole thing. And it's 30 pages per issue. So, I mean, this is a bumper size length here. Covers by Mark Chiarello, and those are some very unique looking covers. So, Gord, you want to just briefly discuss the covers for us, and then we'll dive in and maybe talk more about one of them?
Oh, sure. Well, yeah, the first one is up front and personal. You definitely know who the star of the show is. There's Vig with his and hat is off because he's in a bit of a sweat. The mask is on. He's got a gun pointed at someone in a suit and some other suits behind him who are also pulling guns out. So that you know that you're in a very modern gangsters versus cowboy story. And it's a, what do you call that with the white on the background? Negative.
The white space?
Yes, negative space.
There we go.
That's what I was trying to say. And of course, that really balances out the logo and the trade dress as well. Well, now we go to number two, which has someone that I recognize very well. This is Vigilante's version of the Joker, and his name is, well, it's no wonder Vig has a bit of a complex. His biggest enemy in the last 80 years has been a man called the Dummy.
Irony that you said the biggest, because he's a little tiny guy. Looks like a ventriloquist dummy.
Exactly. He is virtually a Charlie McCarthy. Well, I'm sure I've lost the entire podcast now. Charlie McCarthy, of course, was a ventriloquial character on radio and TV. I thought I'd better carry on with the TV, voiced by a man named Edgar Bergen. But most people knew what Charlie McCarthy looked like because he was well represented in magazines of the day. And there were even, shall we say, action figures of Charlie McCarthy. In fact, I have one in my museum. And he's a very diabolical character. Just think an even smaller version of the Penguin. His features are very chalk white. He wears a top hat. And he's very comical looking, like, say, the prankster with bow ties. But don't let that fool you. The man is psychotic and an extremely dangerous criminal. And he's had just about as big a role in DC's universe, at least in the Roy Thomas's books, as the Vigilante has. In fact, I think Roy Thomas liked the Dummy better than the Vigilante. But
I've always kind of thought the Dummy was sort of a predecessor to Scarface, you know, the Batman talking dummy villain.
That's a good characterization. And in this, it's very similar, actually, to the first issue. He's surrounded by gunsels who are backed up by Thompson submachine guns. And if you don't know what those are those gangster movie type of things with the drum clip that goes in there. So they just go rat-a-tat-tat-tat until it runs out.
I will applaud your usage of the word gunsel. Not a word that you get to use in common discussion very often.
Yeah. See that, sir? Yeah. Not just a hayseed here, eh? And now we go to issue number 3, which is my favorite. I just look at the trade dress on the trade, and that is Vig with hat and mask on, with guns pointed, one pointed at and the other one pointed upward, like he has just fired it and is bringing the other one down. And he is superimposed over what I would call old Las Vegas. Everybody's seen that cowboy animated sign on the Sunset Strip in Las Vegas. All the various logos of, you know, the Rat Pack era of Las Vegas. You got the Flamingo, the Golden Nugget, and the El Dorado, the famous Pioneer Club, El Rancho, Vegas. And there's also a casino called Meskins.
I didn't catch that till now. That's a good one. Yeah. As the co-creator of the character. Yep.
And even though when I say Las Vegas, you think it's got to be gaudy lights, Vig is the only thing. In fact, I think, believe his red kerchief is the only thing that's actually in color. Everything else is very much grayscale, really set off nicely. So there's all kinds of different varieties of gray over top of this.
There's also some blue as well, but it's so muted it goes in perfectly with the gray, at least on the original issue. They may have touched it up for the trade, but the original issue, the bottom half is blue to match his shirt. But either way, it's gorgeous. You're right. The coloring here that Mark Chiarello did, and he's going to do the coloring in the whole series, is just genius. I mean, the coloring's inspired. But go ahead. Describe number 4, and then let's kind of figure out. Like you said, number 3 is your favorite. I'll just show my hand right now. It's my favorite too, by the way.
Okay. Number 4, I think, is the weakest. Even though we're back to negative space with the white on there, it's very expressionistic. You do have a two-fisted Vig. He doesn't have any guns in his hand, but he has just basically knocked out since you love this word, a gunsel, and sent his tie a-flying even as a bullet is popping out of the clip. But I guess what's interesting, we go from Vegas to we've got the Hollywood Hills and the iconic Hollywood real estate sign and a couple of old-timey studio cameras in behind. Vidge and the Gunsel are kind of colored, kind of a dull burnt orange, and against the negative space, it doesn't work for me.
Oh, actually, I agree that it's probably the weakest cover, but I actually really like the coloring, because not only is it that burnt orange that I think is just a strong color, he very purposely colored outside the lines. If you look at it, it's sort of interesting. If you look at his tie, and the guy's got knocked backwards, and his back, and you look at Vidge's side, like, he very purposely splashed the color out like it was done sloppy to sort of help convey the motion and the expediency, or maybe even classic comics, I'm not sure, but I like it. I think it makes a really sharp element to it.
I never thought of it in that way. It looked a little sloppy to me, but yeah, you know, if you okay, all right, okay, you know what, I'm going to subscribe to your newsletter. I understand, I get you now. Yeah, it's conveying motion.
And all over, I mean, I totally agree. Number three is my favorite cover. I think number one is sort of disturbing because, as you described it, I mean, Vigilante, he's not only pointing a gun at a guy, the guy is clearly down on his knees. Vigilante is holding him by his tie, so almost choking the guy, and has the barrel of the gun up against the side of the guy's head. I mean, this looks like execution is what this looks like. And it tells you this is not your dad's superhero or Western story.
You know who I wish I could see a version of if I could reach into heaven and ask him to do this overnight?
Mm-hmm.
Jim Aparo.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
That thing hit me on Thursday. You'd feel it on Monday.
Right, right. That is Vigilante style.
I could see an Aparo version, yeah, of this.
I could totally see that. And props here, by the way, to Mark Chiarello. Like, his covers are extremely cinematic. They have a painterly vibe to them. All the outlines are really thick. Like, especially on issue like number one, the black outline that on the character is just really thick. The dramatic lighting and the great expressions. These are really powerful covers. They're really, really powerful. And again, number three is just amazing with the Las Vegas logos on there.
Now, there's something else I'm getting the vibe, not only from the covers, but we're going to get it from the interior art. This is kind of where I get my chamois out and start waxing Mort Meskin's car, because Mort Meskin was probably, to me, one of the better of the Golden Age artists, because he was really always looking for the camera angle,
mm-hmm,
where a lot of the other artists, you know, who were just kind of figuring comics out, you know, so let's be fair, they never got that sense of dimension and space the way Meskin did. And Meskin, it was all dependent on who his anchor was, or basically how many nights out he'd had. but when Meskin was trucking, it always looked like it could be an animated, like you could animate right from his panels.
Wow. Okay. Now, do you feel like these artists captured some of that, or maybe were thinking along those lines, or you're just giving tribute to Meskin?
I don't think they're trying to capture it. I think the proper word is homage.
Okay. There we go. All right. Well, why don't we get inside this? So there's four issues to cover, so there's a lot here. But what we're going to do is I'm going to read you the credits. I'm going to read you a recap of the story issue by issue, and then we're going to dive in. All right, inside, folks, writer is James Robinson. The artist on all four issues is Tony Sammons. Plus, issue three and four also has some artwork from Brett Blevins. The letter is John Workman. The colorist is Mark Chiarello. Again, the guy who drew the covers is the colorist on the inside. The editors are Archie Goodwin and Chris Duffy. All right, so here is a quick recap of part one. So the story opens in 1942 as mobster Bugsy Siegel stands in the Nevada desert, dreaming of building a casino that will one day become Las Vegas. 2 years later, Greg Saunders has traded the Vigilante costume for a shot at the Hollywood stardom, until tragedy pulls him back. His partner, Stuff, is engaged to an aspiring actress, Stacy, who suddenly disappears. Greg uncovers a horrifying trail of blackmail, exploitation, and human trafficking that leads straight to Bugsy's organization. Stacy is murdered trying to escape, and when Stuff confronts Bugsy, he's beaten to death with a crowbar. Consumed by grief and rage, Vigilante declares war on Bugsy Siegel. So that's issue one. Now we'll do issue two real quick. And again, we'll go through all four of these and then talk about them. In issue two, Vigilante launches a relentless one-man assault on Bugsy's criminal empire. He burns businesses, terrorizes gangsters, and leaves a trail of bruised and broken mobsters behind, hoping to provoke Bugsy into making a fatal mistake. Instead, Bugsy strikes back by hiring an assassin and a former foe of the Vigilante, known only as the Dummy. a pint-sized killer with a razor-sharp temper. The dummy quickly proves just how dangerous he is before luring Vigilante onto Bugsy's gambling ship. But it's all a trap. Hidden explosives destroy the vessel, and Vigilante barely escapes with his life as the war between the two enemies escalates. So, issue 2 ends with a giant explosion of Vigilante. We think he's dead. Part 3, we have now jumped forward an entire year. Bugsy is obsessed with finishing the Flamingo Hotel in Las Vegas. Even his construction costs spiral out of control, and his mob investors begin to suspect that he's stolen millions. Vigilante, still recovering from his injuries, watches from a nearby ranch in Las Vegas, waiting for Bugsy to finally cross a legal line. Instead, Bugsy's world slowly collapses under its own weight. His relationship falls apart, opening night of the Flamingo is a disaster, and his partners quietly decide he's become a liability. While Vigilante stops one of Bugsy's enforcers from murdering his unfaithful girlfriend and her lover, the mob quietly signs Bugsy's own death warrant. Now, for the conclusion in issue 4, learning that the dummy has been hired to assassinate Bugsy, Vigilante faces an unexpected choice. Should he let the killer do his work, or save the man he's been sworn to destroy? Greg ultimately intervenes, determined that Bugsy should answer for the crimes in a court of law, not simply be executed. So he stops the dummy in a brutal showdown, only to be invited back to Bugsy's home afterwards. There, Bugsy admits that he knows the mob wants him dead, and actually wants Vigilante to pull the trigger. At first, Greg refuses, wanting Bugsy to live with the fear. But when Bugsy proudly boasts about murdering stuff, Vigilante finally snaps. Bullets end their 2-year vendetta. Yet victory, it feels hollow, leaving Greg to wonder whether history will remember Bugsy as the ruthless killer or a man who helped build Las Vegas. So there we go, folks. 4 issues of Vigilante, City Lights, Prairie Justice. And the first thing I'll say is, clearly, this is not a superhero story. This is a crime noir story, just happens to star a cowboy. You know, it's more like a hard-boiled detective novel or a gangster film. It's got drugs, adultery, brutal violence, lots of murder, human trafficking. This is not for kids. And in fact, now that I think about it, I don't see recommended for mature readers on the cover. That really should have been on there.
Somebody said that this was a Vertigo, but I can't see Vertigo on the original covers or inside the trade. So I don't know if this is part of that. I don't know. Like I said, I was kind of out of comics during that when the dark comics like Swamp Thing and such became Vertigo. So I don't know if this was published under that. But yeah, you're absolutely right. I'm glad I didn't bring this home in 1995, you know, along with a Power Rangers that I would have given to my 5-year-old.
Right.
Knowing that kid, she was old for her time and she would have got it anyway. Before we go further into this, I have to say that I absolutely believe, and I don't know if there's ever been any texts or off-media been done about this book, but I absolutely believe that James Robinson was influenced by a movie. Hmm. And when I knew what that movie was, and I knew we were going to do this a couple of weeks ago, I went back and watched that and I went, yep, this is that movie. The movie is Bugsy, starring Warren Beatty and Annette Bening.
I remember that, yeah.
1991, it was late 1991, so it actually would have hit video in 1992. So I'm sure James Robinson had that cooking around in his brain when he did this, because if you watch that movie, there are some things that pop out of here, and it's almost shot for shot.
That makes a lot of sense. So a couple of things I didn't know going in, and this is just my own ignorance. I should have, but I didn't know Bugsy Siegel was a real person, you know, and once you do a little research on him, I mean, this story is within a stretch of imagination with, you know, Vigilante in there and stuff like that. For the most part, this is pretty faithful to what happened to Bugsy and how his whole life spiraled out of control for real. And here's my theory. I sort of hinted at this to you, Gord, before we started recording. I think after reading this, especially like issue 3, which is really just a Bugsy issue narrated by the Vigilante. I mean, the Vigilante is barely even active in that issue. I kind of think that James Robinson actually wanted to tell the Bugsy story and just put the Vigilante in there as an excuse to make it work, because it really does feel like this is more Bugsy's story than Vigilante's. I don't know. You think I'm crazy on this?
Oh, I agree. And I think what makes it good is Bugsy Siegel is just the kind of villain that Vigilante would have had in the 1940s. Yeah, you had your dummies and you had your Rainbow Man and people like that, but there was always some kind of a gangster kicking around. It was almost like the way Batman and Robin was. When they weren't hitting the gaudy villains, it was always these guys in the cheap suits.
Right.
It was always talking like this. Well, those guys talking like this were always based on the real people that were in the news. Charles Lucky Luciano, Meyer Lansky, and of course, Bugsy Siegel, and so many others. I mean, Hollywood just loves these guys. And that's, of course, going to be a theme inside this as well.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And I do feel like the comic gave enough space and breathing room to share the true historical pieces of it. Like, I found fascinating reading about the history of the flamingo in this comic and how it all fell apart and all spiraled out of control. And we've all managed a project at some point in our life that just did not go the way we wanted. So, I mean, there's parts where you actually feel sorry for Bugsy as it's all falling apart. Cause I'm like, oh, I've been there. I've been that guy who, you know, can't manage the project because it's all falling apart. And so I just found it, I guess I shouldn't even say historically, because it felt like you were part of the story. You felt like you were there. It felt today. And it was really well written. Really, and the mob politics, really. James Robinson found a way to capture the true history and make it work in a comic that made it feel relevant.
Hollywood has always loved Bugsy Siegel and Luciano and all of these guys. The Godfather, I don't know if you realize this, Mo Green in The Godfather is Bugsy Siegel.
Okay.
When you watch that, they talk to him because the man who found Las Vegas. And one of the Corleone boys, Fredo, goes to work for Mo Green. And eventually Mo Green does get hit because he knocked around Fredo a little bit. But virtually Mo Green is Siegel. So, and he's also been featured in Boardwalk Empire and just so many other things. So I think that's why you probably were easy to pull him out of the air, because he's always been in the air. Mm. People have always been fascinated by this story.
Makes sense. It really does. So in addition to the history in here, one of the things we got to talk about is the art, right? Because the art in this book is very unique. It's very fitting for crime noir. And it's not your usual polished superhero art, you know? And I don't know that it's for everyone. But the best way I can describe it is it's very deliberately rough and very expressive. And sometimes it even looks a little sketchy. But the sketchiness works, right? Especially with movement. It has like this frenetic energy to it. And also the characters, they are not glamorous, right? Even though we're dealing with Hollywood, right? Even starlets and stuff, the characters, they have crooked noses, they're tired, they're awkward body language, they have exaggerated expressions. And the violence is interesting in this too, because the violence, you know, in a superhero comic, you mentioned Jim Aparo, right? No one throws a punch like Jim Aparo, you know, in a comic. Well, the violence here, it doesn't look cool. It looks painful, right? The gunfights are chaotic. It's like very hard to follow what's going on. The punches look like you're going to be suffering afterwards. And the closest comparison artistically I can come up with is it looks to me, and it's, I'm not saying it's exact. You're not going to look at this and go, oh yeah, but I mean, it's sort of like a Tim Sale book in that the sketchiness, the people are not attractive necessarily, and it's very stylized, but it still works.
I get that, because Tim Sale has always reminded me of the old, quote, Bob Kane, unquote, Batman and Robin stories. You know, where you just loved it when Batman and Robin got together and were solving crimes more than just, you know, running around on big typewriters and things like that. But I get your discomfort with the expressionism, because I'll tell you, I had to read this two or three times the first time I got it. And yeah, it finally clicks in. And then when you look at Meskin, and okay, maybe there's a bit of an homage, but I think that's probably the idea. The chaos is the purpose. And that's what's coming in. And it's not an easy thing to read. I almost wish there was more text to it. Hmm. I really do. Now, for me, you know, I'm doing my Bobby Bittman as a historian in all seriousness. You know, I know how to look this stuff up. I probably got books right here in this room if I wasn't too lazy to go up and pick them up. But, you know, we live in that age where we can research this stuff. And, of course, it's all over the movies. And the Las Vegas thing is very... It's as documented as a mobster story can, but everybody knows that how Vegas was built. Originally, it was just a kind of a desert zoo that had some slot machines during the war. And wherever you had that kind of a thing, well, the mob was always going to get a taste. And Siegel just happened to pop through just to, you know, collect his tribute at some point during the war. And he stopped and says, why can't this be more? Why can't this be bigger? And especially when he goes outside of town a mile or two and realizes, hey, this land is worthless. We can build something on it and make something out of it. And of course, it's Nevada. Nevada was dead broke in the 1940s. So they're willing to do anything. They don't have oil. You can't farm the place. And so the Nevada legislature is just willing to turn its head while somebody brings in some commerce. And we see this all the time. You know, we put coal mines where they don't belong and we drill oil where it doesn't belong just because people say, well, what about the jobs? And in a sense, that's what they did. They got in there and they crowbarred their way into it. I don't know where I was headed with this metaphor, but.
Well, one of the things I like in the book, too, though, is they point out that they're doing it in an effort to also make the mob look a little more legitimate. They're hoping that these casinos will help give them some legitimacy, and they want to become, you know, upstanding citizens. They don't want to be known as hoods. They want their legacy to be upstanding citizens that built something amazing.
We have appearances. The character is used quite a bit here, but there's a real character. Hollywood actor by the name of George Raft. Rob Kelly is right now is screaming, George Raft, yay! Well, George Raft was, he made gangster movies. And the reason he made gangster movies is because he was palling around with them. Mm. He knew them. And whenever they came to town, well, they looked up George, and that's who they went out drinking and partying and you know what and with. And
there's some you know what in this book too.
Oh, more than a little bit, yes. So you know, it also, this book is also going to speak to that glamour where Hollywood can kind of be accused of turning its head the same way the state of Nevada did, and the officials of the town and soon to be city of Las Vegas, as they have just kind of turned away from their role where prohibition money turned into drug money and is suddenly being, let's face it, it's being laundered out here. They're running it through, you know, craps tables and black roulette wheels and slot machines. And the entertainment business is along for the ride.
And the LA scenes are interesting because there is drug use there. And you mentioned the different celebrities. Like Gary Cooper is hanging out with Greg Saunders at one point, showing him around, offering to introduce him to gangsters, right? Which is kind of crazy. And we should probably talk about the plot in general, too, which is, I mean, Stuff comes to see him because he's just gotten engaged to this girl, Stacy. And Stacy wants an audition in Hollywood. And Vigilante's kind of put in a bad place where he's got to arrange the audition. And Stacy doesn't have enough money for the audition. She doesn't have enough money for to get some new dresses. So she goes and does some, ultimately ends up doing some skin flicks to raise some money and ends up getting caught up in a human trafficking scenario where she's taken off to Tijuana. They're going to sell her and she tries to get away. They end up murdering her and Stuff goes down in a rage because he's, you know, he found out his girl has been taken by these guys and gets himself killed by Bugsy. And that's really what sets the whole story off. Because I mean, Greg Saunders, he basically loses everything. You know, the death of Stuff, the death of Stacy, he loses his Hollywood career. All of this is personal, right? And then he gets severely injured in the explosion. So the nice thing is, rather than, you know, your sort of generic superhero comic where it's like, okay, well, I fight crime, so I'm going to go fight crime. Here, it's become incredibly personal for Vig. And so that really drives the story and it becomes his obsession with Bugsy that, I mean, this story takes place over, what, 2 years, I think, right? And so it's a long vengeance.
It kind of scatters out over 5 years, I think. It kind of starts with 42. I want to say it's 1942 when apparently Vig is going to Hollywood and he's getting screen tested and things like that. Then it jumps to 44 and then we kind of linger out until 47.
Okay.
Stuff is totally in character from the Mort Meskin and Joe Samichson and whoever else was scripting back in those days. He was impetuous. He was always getting himself into fights and he could usually get himself out of it. But now, of course, he's over his head because, well, he's a little older and things have dropped on the boy and he's not seeing straight.
There, exactly. He's letting his emotions run wild, which Vig even warns him. He says, look, when someone's wound up like you are, they make mistakes, and that's what happens. But I'm going to assume the Stuff getting murdered in 1944 is not continuity for what you know with Vigilante's history. Is that fair?
Oh, now we're going to get in the weeds. Okay.
All right. We don't have time for a 45-minute TED Talk, okay?
All right. Stuff is with Vig right until the end in 1954.
Okay.
He never really appears in any of the 70s appearances until World's Finest in about 1977. I want to say 254, but don't quote me on that. One of the Gray Morrow, Bill Kunkel stories, Stuff. When Stuff reappears, well, the dummies caught him first, and he's at the end of a rope. So we're into the many deaths of stuff here.
Gotcha.
So continuity, don't worry about what earth we're on, folks. It doesn't work. It just doesn't work. We can't do it. We're telling a story.
And I think that's ultimately at the end of the day, that's what this is. They're trying to tell a story and they're trying to give a very personal motivation to Vigilante. And they did. And for me, as an outsider who doesn't know all the deep history, it worked for me. It was powerful.
Now, Jeff Johns gets all screwy with this and he brings up a twin brother. And interestingly enough, in the Golden Age, there is a twin brother kicking around. So, and then if you go back to the Bill Kunkel stories, there's a stuffed junior. Let's stop right there. Like, we're going to Hawkman poor stuff here.
Right. So we know we're playing with continuity here. So that brings up another question. So in the original stories, obviously he's a troubadour, right? And he's a singing cowboy. So did he ever do acting prior in any of those? Or is it always just the troubadour stuff? And where did he do that? I'm guessing on the radio or something?
Well, it was mostly on the radio. He was like a lot of these cowboy singers. You'd go to New York City and you'd get yourself a daily show. Mm. You'd get yourself a show that would be 15, 20 minutes. And then, of course, your time was your own. And from there on, you record. Or you could probably, if you were in Hollywood doing this, you could have some time to go work on movies and such. There was one guy, actually in Calgary of all places. Well, where would you find a cowboy singer? Wilf Carter. He started out with a 15-minute radio show. And then he'd go down and he'd work at the Calgary Stampede and flip flapjacks and play around with the chuck wagons and things like that. So this is what they do. And of course, if you got noticed, then Hollywood would come talking and they'd come off, you know, there'd be a little bit bigger money than, you know, the radio show kind of went away. And of course, this was always in support of selling your records. In these days, you didn't have albums like with 10 songs, the way you would have it on a CD or a digital today. They were on 78 RPMs and you'd have one song on one side and one song on the other. And just the same size as a vinyl record that we think of now. And then you had to keep that vinyl going and you had to keep it going and going and going. You might put out six of those vinyls per year. We never got into long playing records until probably into the 1950s when teenagers had a lot of money.
Gotcha. And they do make a reference to that in the story. The girl, Stacy, says she's got all of his records. She mentions she has all of Vidge's records. So there we go. So another thing I thought was interesting, you know, Vidge is using the dictaphone in here to narrate as a framing device, really. He's using it to narrate the story. He's giving us sort of, again, that film noir, you know, detective sort of description of what's going on. He's recording his thoughts there. Is the dictaphone, is that a traditional thing for Vidge or just from this story?
I haven't run across it.
Okay.
I haven't seen it. Now, the dictaphone, if people don't know what we're talking about, it would be a 1940s version of a tape recorder.
Yeah, right.
Earlier, you would have these. They would cut into a wax cylinder. Just think of what a candle and a wax.
Yeah.
And you made a cylinder and you talked into a horn, not necessarily a microphone. And as you talked, it would make cuttings into this wax. Well, by this time, they're looking into a thing called Lexan, I want to say, which is sort of a very early forerunner of plastic. We're not into plastics as we know it now. And it would make kind of a disc, but it was like a mini disc. If you remember records, it used to get in cereal boxes.
Oh, yeah.
Those cheap things that would always ruin your dad's record player. not saying that I did that, but at any rate, that's kind of what it's making. And so you'll always have this kind of a recording. And then the microphone magnetic tape probably comes along in the 50s.
Gotcha.
So what he's using, and that's why he's has this very unusual horn there. It's not an actual microphone as we know it. Okay. You'd use microphones in the radios, but that was live.
Right. Well, it makes a great, you know, again, framing device for the story. So rather than just hearing his thoughts, we're hearing a dictation, and it makes it really good for the reader to follow along what's going on.
Well, that's interesting because we always say, why do we bring sidekicks? Why do we bring in Robins and Buckys and Jimmy Olsons? We always say because the hero needs somebody to talk to. Well, he's just lost his guy to talk to. So now he talks to the dictaphone.
Good point.
Jimmy Olsen, you can be replaced by a tape recorder at any time.
Look out, the MP3 player is taking your job, Jimmy.
Yeah.
So you end up, he's lost stuff. He's on this, you know, Vigilante. Sorry for the, you know, choice of the words, but he's on this path to take down Bugsy for this, gets blown, you know, the dummy comes in, his arch enemy, gets blown up on a ship, and literally in between issue 2 and 3, he loses a year of his life. He is injured and he's recovering for a year on this ranch. He's purposely bought a ranch out in that, like you said, that worthless desert, so he can keep an eye on the Flamingo Hotel that's being built to watch Bugsy. So that was shocking to me, because I'm like, okay, I know that contradicts the comics from 1944 to 1945, right? So,
But Shag, and in Action Comics 146 in 1945, clearly he is having 8 continuous adventures with stuff at the same time. This does not contradict.
Okay. All right. You just became that guy. All right.
I just became Jeff Johns. Now I have to find an excuse.
All right. You got
to
make it work.
I have to go make a bunch of stuffs.
All the continuity has to work. It all has to work. Oh, gosh. So then we get into like issue 3. Like I said, issue 3 is, in my opinion, just Bugsy's story. I mean, it's just the story of him and the casino and his girlfriend and his girl side piece and his henchmen, all these things, and how it all falls apart. And, you know, interestingly, in real life, he's known to have skimming money. And here, they actually try and, I mean, they're not saying they're painting him as a good guy, but they actually try and say it was his wife or girlfriend that was skimming the money and he was covering for her. So, you know, he's supposed to look, I guess, a little valiant covering for, I suppose.
Well, the Flamingo was only supposed to cost $1 million and George Raft was going to bring all his friends out for the openings. Well, then it became $2 million. Then it became $4 million. And well, the pipes don't work. This don't work. And I love the way they go through that, because if you watch the Bugsy movie, it's the same thing. Oh. The drapes are flammable, and we can't seem to find enough water out of the artesian well out in the desert. It's all this kind of thing. So the costs are going up, and you're absolutely right. Virginia Hill was skimming money, but you know, you're it's criminal stealing money from criminals is what it is.
Exactly.
And of course, Bugsy, just like Stuff, is thinking with his trousers. And he's not watching Virginia Hill. And the thing about Siegel, you never called him Bugsy to his face, because he just hated that, because you were calling him crazy. You know, he wanted to be called Benjamin or Benny. He was in some ways intelligent, but he would get things into his head. Things like, I'm going to go and assassinate Mussolini and stuff like that. And then you couldn't get him to think of anything else. And meanwhile, you could do circles around him and he would never notice. And of course, with somebody, when you're dealing with somebody that, like I say, thought with his trousers, Mr. Siegel just wasn't watching the books. And who knows how many contractors she was working with to make sure that they were extenuating, that make sure that a 2x4 became a 2x8 on the books.
Right. And you mentioned his outrage at being called Bugsy, and that's actually why he kills Stuff, is because Stuff kept calling him Bugsy. And then he beats him to death with a crowbar, by the way. So I guess there's a bit of a precedent here for sidekicks being beaten to death by crowbars. Not a pretty sight, but...
Yeah, I did notice that.
Thankfully, we weren't given the opportunity to have a call in number to decide whether Stuff would make it out of this comic or not. But so, you know,
I know who did that. wait a minute. No, I was promised not to say that. It was part of the Accords. Sorry.
I know a few people actually who called to vote on that. But so the story continues. Bugsy, his whole empire falls apart. The mob has decided they're going to kill him, and they hire the dummy, from earlier in the issues to kill Bugsy. And then Vidge ends up saving him. He decides that he wants Bugsy to face justice. So he goes, he has what at least in the comic appears to be a final battle with Dummy. It looks like the Dummy falls to his death and dies, but obviously that wouldn't make sense for the stories that come later. And in the end, Bugsy, like you said, he is an intelligent guy. He invites Vigilante to his house, and they have a very rational discussion where Bugsy's like, look, I'm going to die. The mob's going to rub me out, but I want a guy with guts. I want a real man. I want somebody who's intelligent, who passion, who cares to be the one to kill me. I want you to kill me. And makes for an interesting discussion, a moral problem.
Benny lives in that world where everything is just business. Okay. If I'm not going to pay my debts, well, they're going to come and they're going to collect, and they're going to collect with my blood. They're not going to get their money back, but they're going to get their satisfaction. And that's how they police their whole world of business. We don't mind, Ben. We really like you. But you know what? This is business. And of course, this is all the whole ending of Godfather and how they always pay their debts at the very end. It doesn't matter how close they were. It doesn't matter whether they were army buddies or or palled around in 30 years ago. When it comes to money, it's serious, and we can't mess around because that would make the mob look stupid, and we can't afford to look ridiculous.
So as a vigilante expert, the ending, I'm curious how you feel about this ending, because what happens there is, you know, Bugsy asks him to kill him. Vigilante refuses. He wants Bugsy to suffer. He wants him to always be looking over his shoulder, waiting for the mob to kill him. But then Bugsy suddenly, you know, again, smart guy, he knows the triggers that are going to bother, no pun intended with trigger, by the way. He knows what's going to bother Vigilante. And so he says, oh yeah, I remember killing stuff. Oh yeah, he cried. He begged for me not to do it. And he says all these terrible things. And Vigilante's like, okay, boom, 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 boom. And kills Bugsy and says, you know, you're welcome or whatever. So how do you feel as a Vigilante fan with that very morally questionable execution he did of Bugsy?
Well, you know, I'm glad you asked. Vigilante is not Batman in that Vigilante grew up in a hard country where people do sometimes disappear. And, you know, he grew up as the son of a sheriff, and sometimes sheriffs, you know, have to do things to bend laws. And he worked at his dad's side, probably as a deputy. And let's face it, he's seen some things. Now, Vigilante, I've never seen him as an out-and-out killer, even though we call him Vigilante. More often than not, he's the guy that brings them back alive and puts them in. Having said that, if some criminal starts to trip and go into a hazard, something, you know, Greg Saunders isn't going to save him. He's going to say, well, you save the court some money. But he's not Punisher either. He's not even Adrian Chase. He just doesn't pick up guns and blow things miraculously. I've talked a lot about in the last few episodes of Prairie Justice, that Vig often, you know, he hits more people with his guns than he seems to kill them. He gets out of death traps more with his spurs and his rope than he does with guns. You know, the gun is just kind of a last resort for him. But let's face it, we're not dealing with the average garden variety kid gang here. We're dealing with someone that has been responsible one way or the other for the deaths of thousands of people, especially when you bring drugs and all of these other things into it. And God knows what he did in the Prohibition era, you know, how many hundreds of people that he's been on. So I think Vig does believe in the law, but he also believes, I think, in a flexible law. So I don't see this as a Henry Cavill Man of Steel moment.
Gotcha.
This is going to happen. This Vig is going to do it when he sees fit.
And I totally get that. And it's interesting that, you know, it's for us, the reader, it's a bit of a cathartic, you know, moment as it's just like a full page splash. You're just like, rat-a-tat-tat-tat-tat-tat, you know, that sort of thing.
But it's interesting that this is a last resort, because as we say, he spent 2 years psyching this guy out, stalking him, watching him off of a horse. He's at the Flamingo. He buys the ranch next to the casino just to sit there on the hill and watch him and just, you know, put the fear of God into him. And this is what finally happens. Bugs has been put over the edge, and he probably feels if he's going to be taken down by Meyer Lansky or if he can take him down by Greg Saunders, it doesn't matter. And he'd rather Greg Saunders did it.
Yeah, no, that sums it up perfectly. And you talk about him shooting people. I mean, in this story, he does kill a lot of people, but it's always in a battle. They always have a gun. They're always the person he's fighting. They always have a gun. They're always shooting at him. They're trying to kill him. So it's more of a defensive action. It's not like Punisher. He's not going and executing people. So really what happens there with Bugsy is an execution, and it is the only one in the book. And at the end, it's interesting. We felt the cathartic release, but he actually is like sitting in the chair at the end, and he feels emotionally hollow. Like, is even, you know, was it a moral failure? I mean, he's really thinking about it. I mean, he's not like terribly upset, but he is thinking, you know, I don't feel any release like I thought I would.
Well, I would just say, folks, read this book, then go watch Bugsy, and you'll see that in the end, you can put Greg anywhere in at that end. it's a mystery ending. And when I watch it and then I see the ending and you don't know who's knocked him down, I'm going to go, well, I guess there is some prairie justice.
There it is. There it is. Now, I do have some insight to share that all credit to the internet. I am not this deep. Okay. But it really was interesting when I read this. Basically, the idea is that the real antagonist in the story is not Bugsy. It's Obsession itself. Because, you know, Greg here, you know, the vigilante, the revenge, it costs him 2 years of his life, right? Bugsy's obsession with the flamingo, it costs him his fortune, his relationship, and ultimately his life. You know, both men are pursuing a single goal with tunnel vision, and both end the story having achieved it, but neither find any satisfaction from it. I mean, when I read that, I was like, okay, that's brilliant. That's a really interesting, deep observation. I don't know if that's what James Robinson was going for, but it's certainly, if you look at it from that sort of picture, all about obsession, it really is a tale of obsession.
Yeah, I think that there is that theme. You know, let's face it, the best friend, and then, of course, getting blown to pieces off that boat. You know, he can't forget this. This whole situation has destroyed his career. He's destroyed his friendships and destroyed his love life, for all we know. And, you know, before he goes off and with his last thing into the Seven Soldiers of Victory and gets tossed into time. See, hey, there you go. Maybe that's part of the mystery. The guy disappeared the next day. It took Johnny Thunder to find him.
So lucky for that.
Okay, we're bending the continuity a little here.
So I only have one more note on here as far as the art goes, like the coloring. So we talked about earlier, again, you know, the colorist is Mark Chiarello, the guy who did the covers. And we praised his coloring on the covers, right? He's carried that same sort of philosophy inside the book. He's using a lot of muted earth tones, browns, grays, you know, very faded colors. Then you get things like the neon signs, the gunfire. Any spot he wants you to notice are really bright and contrast that. And it makes it super sharp. So I think the coloring, working with, again, that sketchy art style, makes it a very interesting book to read. I mean, again, it's not the kind of book you're going to look at and go, this is beautiful. No, it's not. Actually, everyone's ugly. The world is ugly, but it's on purpose. And it really effectively, a storytelling technique.
Oh, everything is akimbo and askew. Yeah. Let's face it. I mean, there is no realism anywhere here. I mean, somebody's smoking a cigar and it looks like a fog, you know, it looks like a London fog. I mean, everything does have that hint of Frank Milleristic exaggeration, Dark Knight exaggeration. And like you said, the coloring, and I was just kind of flipping through and looking at some of the faces, and it goes just the faces. And these are mostly white people. And unfortunately, stuff is done with that copper thing that they were doing in the 40s.
Yeah, they were doing some in the 90s, too, unfortunately.
But yeah, I mean, sometimes there's one of Virginia Hill where she's driving down out in the desert, and it's kind of a nightfall situation, and her face is just kind of brown with a little bit of moon glow off of the side. So they're really working on the coloring.
Yeah.
And folks, this is a story you might have to read two or three times.
Yeah.
Read it once, watch Bugsy, then read it again. That's all I can say.
I definitely had to read it twice to get all the nuances of it, for sure.
And even in this, Wikipedia is your friend. I mean, there are some very good articles on Bugsy Siegel. There's one I was surprised. You know, you always think you see this random gangster and that random gangster. There's one named James Reagan that they talk about poisoning him with mercury. And that is exactly what they did with the real James Reagan.
Jeez.
They couldn't get at him. They couldn't nail him out on the street. At any rate, at some point, they found him in the hospital and they slowly poisoned him with mercury.
Wow. I got a sense that was probably real. Again, that was, I think, in issue 3 when they're going through and basically telling Bugsy's story. And I really got a sense of that.
Got to tell you how that hit home with me.
Okay.
When I was about 2 years old, for whatever reason, my mom and dad left some seed dressing out around. And it's a seed treatment that prevents your seed from rotting in the ground after you put into it. And a 2-year-old Ranger Gord decided he'd have a slurp of that.
Oh.
Well, they ran me to the next town, pumped out my stomach, and then ran me to the city. And then I got out in time for Christmas 1965 in a blizzard. But the point is, I'm sitting here, and to this day, I have issues with dyslexia.
Wow.
And when I looked up the MSDS sheets on this chemical that I took, it was mercury based.
Oh.
And so when they talk about that slow death by mercury, I keep thinking about those doctors pumping my stomach out at the Milk River Hospital.
Wow.
And, you know, how they got it. I mean, I could have been a lot worse. I could have not made it to the city.
Thank goodness they did what they did to save you. And also, by the way, we have you to thank for all those poison stickers that were so popular in the 70s that all the parents put on bottles.
Thanks, Gorge.
All right, Ranger Gord, as we're sort of winding it down here, I got a big picture question for you. You're our vigilante expert, right? I mean, you're, as far as I'm concerned, the vigilante expert. And we have just spent, I don't know, an hour and 19 minutes. I don't know what it'll get edited down to. I mean, I'm going to cut out like every third thing you said. But as of this point, we have spent a lot of time talking about Bugsy and not as much time talking about Vigilante in a series called Vigilante. So do you feel that Greg Saunders got shortchanged in the story, or do you think it's okay the way it was done?
You're thinking he was a guest in his own book.
Well, I mean, yeah. Do you think that? I'm asking you as the Vigilante expert.
You're absolutely probably right. I think he wanted to tell the Siegel story, only Vigilante was an excuse to do it. But having said that, there was a lot of things I saw in there. And, you know, for example, he talked about losing his younger brother mm-hmm. on the ranch to a fever. He didn't say what kind of fever it was in 1936. And so there was little things that popped up in there that, to me, advanced Greg Saunders' character even more. And let's face it, even over 80-odd years, Greg Saunders' character hasn't advanced all that much. He's certainly got a long ways to go to become the psychological nightmare that is Bruce Wayne. But, but having said that, it's a story, folks. Sometimes I think we let continuity and our wish to have something else mar our enjoyment, or I don't know if enjoyment is the proper word, our appreciation of just having a good story told. And this is a hard story. It's a tough story. And the way it's expressed, it's still even hard to read. I don't think it flows as easy as Starman does. Not at all. It probably flows a little bit better than most of the Grant Morrison stuff that you might see. But at the very end, we do know that there's an end, and it hits on a historical note too. To this day, nobody knows who brought Bugsy Siegel out, and nobody's asking questions. You know, we've been talking about JFK for how many years? Everybody's got a pet conspiracy theory. Nobody wants to touch the Siegel story. Nobody wants to open that wound. So it's kind of neat that a comic book of all things, even in Vertigo, decided to try to put an exclamation point on that particular historical mystery. And, you know, Vegas today, I don't live far from Vegas myself. I could be there in a day. I've never actually been to Las Vegas. I've been all over northern Nevada for God knows whatever reason. But, you know, it means a lot to people up here. There used to be a lot of people when they used to go down gambling before the online thing started to hit and video lottery terminals. My mom and dad used to go down there all the time, even before I was born. And we have pictures. This is the Rat Pack days of the 60s, you know, and they had pictures of the flamingo. They might have even been in that. I don't know. And I had pictures of the big postcards of the big cowboy doing the wave down there. So it's always kind of been in my zeitgeist one way or the other. It certainly didn't start with CSI. Vegas has always been something that's been around me, and it's always interesting to note. You know, you think about how different cities start. You know, well, this Jebediah Springfield stood on a rock and proclaimed this river's drainage system. Well, what happened in Vegas? Basically a drug runner. He went out into the middle of the street and said, let's build a nightclub. And that has turned into, you know, one of the biggest things that the United States has ever known.
Right, right. Well, that was a fantastic summation there. And I think you hit some really good points saying that, folks, this is just a story and it's got a lot of historical context and it's a great story. It's a great read. It is, like you said, it's a little challenging because of the historical jumps, some of the extreme violence, things like that. But if you were ever a fan of Starman, if you're ever a fan of Firearm, anything that James Robinson's written, I think you're going to enjoy this. Just know you're going to get a much darker story than you're probably used to, but it's a worthwhile story. And I do feel like I got to know, circling back to that question I asked you, I do feel like I got to know Vigilante by reading this. I had very little exposure to him, but now I feel like I have an idea, at least this version of who Greg Saunders is, and I find he's a fascinating character. And if there was another story to read out there with him in this sort of style, I'd probably be game for it.
Yeah, well, what I have ever I've known is the Fire and Water Network makes things happen. But before you do that, anyone out there, before you write that story, remember there needs to be a Mort Meskin collective of vigilante stories, because they did all the archive editions and they stopped before they got met the Meskin. That's a crime. It's a war crime, damn it.
All right, we'll put that out in the ether, guys. Let's try and make that happen.
We got Charlton archives, for Christ's sakes, before we got Meskin. Come on.
All right. Well, now, folks, we are going to have a very tough job here where we have to nominate our favorite moment from the issue in something called the All-Star Award. Now, whether it's going to be a story beat, something in the art, something that's made us laugh, whatever it is, both myself and Ranger Gord are going to pick one moment each to spotlight, and each of those moments will earn an All-Star Award. Now, Gord, you're our guest here. Why don't you tell us your pick for the moment in here that you want to give an All-Star Award to?
Well, mine isn't so much a moment as it is a sequence, and it's one of the last battles of the entire thing. And it's when Vigilante finally, he's headed to Vegas on his motorbike, and the entire gang is gunning for him. And the reason he's headed to Vegas, though, is to save Siegel, not to go after him, because the dummy has decided to go after Siegel. So there's this whole running battle, runs from pages 4 to 17, but I'm telling you, it runs quick. And let's just say at the end, the dummy gets the usual supervillain's ending, falls into a light, basically, and is electrocuted to death. But you know what? We've all read Joker stories, so we know how that ends. The dummy's not gone, folks. But as far as this story, it is. And it's so interesting that we put so much effort and so much talent into these many, many pages in the climax of the story just to save the main villain from a different villain. So it's kind of interesting. When would Batman put that kind of effort to save Ra's al Ghul from the Joker?
Good question. Good moral question. And I love the art in these sequences. Like when Vigilante comes flying into the motorcycle, and I do mean flying, he is up in the air with a shotgun blasting down, and he's cocking it at the same time. It's really awesome. And that running battle with the dummy, it is a very great payoff for 4 issues, and to see that big, long running battle. That's a great choice. Good pick.
There was only one thing I didn't like. I've never in my life seen a lever action shotgun. But at any rate, I'm willing to go past that. And the flying motorcycle is a vigilante trope. and it was even used in that cartoon. There's nothing. I always assumed that Vigilante always had the gas tank of his gas-eaten Bronc wired at all times. So when he decided that, I'm run out of things to do, let's find a 2x4, ride it to the end, and flick the switch. See what's next.
Fast and the Furious owes a lot to the flying motorcycle here, what they learned. So, my pick is Vigilante is not actually in the scene I picked, but it's about Vigilante. So in issue 2, he is putting the heat on Bugsy's life. He's doing everything he can to really crank up the heat and try and frustrate Bugsy to the point where Bugsy's going to make a mistake. And it kind of, there's a boiling over in issue 2 on pages 13 and 14, where like the butler is bringing Bugsy his breakfast and he's bringing on a silver tray and you don't even see it. You see this closed door and you hear all the scribbles and stuff like that, and the door slams open and Bugsy yells, "Breakfast? Eggs? I don't want eggs. Next time bring me a tray. I want the Vigilante's head on it." And page 14 is this amazing. It's so, you mentioned Frank Miller earlier. When you did, I almost jumped out of my chair because I'm like, oh, this is a Frank Miller page. This looks so Frank Miller. It looks just like Sin City. It's all black and white, except there's a tremendous amount of red overlay on it. And Bugsy is just, he's destroyed the room. The light is shining through the horizontal blind. So you've got that sort of Frank Miller lighting, and he just looks defeated. He's hunched over and he's so upset. And it's just a powerful moment. And Vigilante, without even touching him, has sort of brought Bugsy down, and I just love that moment.
You've got that pattern of the Venetian blinds, yes, all over him.
That's what I'm trying to say. Yes,
and you know what? It almost symbolizes a jail cell.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Yeah, it kind of does, doesn't it? You're right. The bars. Yeah.
Here's what that scene reminds me of, and I kind of wonder if it's a callback. Adventure Comics in about 1972, and it's, again, shout out to Rob Kelly. It's the one with the Adventurers Club in it.
Mm-hmm.
There is a backup story with Vigilante where a girl that he was kind of sweet on has gotten hooked on drugs and ended up getting killed or ODing or some darn thing. I can't remember. Vig walks into this guy, this businessman's office, and he tips his hat to the secretary. He goes, "Hi, ma'am." And the secretary goes, "Wait, you can't go in there." He goes in. He closes the door. You don't see what happens inside, but you hear thump, bump, 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 thump. The next scene is he comes back through the door, tips his hat and goes, "Good day, ma'am." And the next scene is the door swings open and this guy comes out and he's just in a mad rage and he's just been beat to a pulp and he's got a gun in his hand. He's going to go chase Vigilante, ends up getting killed in the street by a car.
Oh, wow. Wow.
So this is a very good callback to that, if that is such a thing.
It could be. I definitely think there's a Frank Miller influence here going on. I think that as well. Because, I mean, Sin City, all black and white, spots, spot colors. Yeah. Yeah, right. So awesome stuff. Both great picks for a great magazine, or great book, I should say. So now, Gord, I need to ask a favor. Would you mind hanging out here for a bit? I'm sure the Flamingo Casino Ballroom could use a new troubadour, and I think you're just the guy for it.
You know what? I think old Dobbin needs some oats, so I'll just head out to the shed and do the chores. Well, you head on out and go about your business.
Fair enough. And don't worry, Ranger Gord. We will bring you back at the end of the show, but after this podcast promo break, I'm going to read your listener feedback in a segment called The Society Pages.
You're listening to Prairie Justice, a Greg Sanders Vigilante podcast. Is an exploration of the DC Comics character, the first superhero to use the name of the Vigilante. First published in Action Comics 42 in September 1941, amid comics' golden age and carried as a continuous feature, during those years the Vigilante was also a member of the Seven Soldiers of Victory and was one of the first DC heroes to appear on the cinema screen in his own serial. Reappearing in the Bronze Age, the Vigilante had a 1970s renaissance throughout the DC universe. Greg Sanders, the Prairie Troubadour, leads a double life as a modern country and western musician, while also delivering justice throughout North America as a masked crime fighter, using the tactics and weapons of his rural Wyoming upbringing. With his friends Billy Gunn and Stuff Leong, many a nefarious scheme was foiled with six guns, ingenuity, a motorcycle, and a twirling lariat. Howdy, I'm Ranger Gord. Help me follow the trail of the Vigilante on Podbean, Apple Podcasts, and Google Play.
Just imagine the mightiest heroes of our time.
All of them on one team.
Since there are so many of us, we have a chance to do more than just put out fires. We can be proactive. We can do some real good in the world.
JLU Cast brings you coverage of Justice League Unlimited, the ultimate gathering of DC's heroes and villains, and the culmination of the greatest interpretation of the DC Universe ever.
Join Chris and Cindy Franklin as they relive the team-ups, the battles, the conspiracies.
I had no idea that the Girl Scouts were responsible for the crop circle phenomenon.
Few people do. Few even think to ask the question.
The romance and the fun.
A head start. You're getting soft in your old age.
Don't you have a tall building to go leap?
And the adventure continues.
Find us wherever fine Fire and Water podcasts are available.
The Society Pages.
The Society Pages is the segment of the show where we cover your feedback from the previous episode. Now, in the beginning of this episode, I mentioned that this is part of Western Comics Month, which is pretty cool. So if you look on social media, a lot of folks are shining a spotlight on Western comics, you know, from the six shooters and the stagecoaches to heroes, you know, the folks who brought justice to the frontier. So if you go on social media and look for the hashtag Western Comics Month, you will see lots of people sharing different Western comics they're reading in the month of July 2026. So hey, why don't you read a few as well and share those out on social media. Now, something else of interest, you may want to check out, or I would recommend you check out the most recent episode of DC Special Cast that was released back on July 5th. That episode features the host Paul Keen with his amazingly talented guest host for that episode, which is me. And we're discussing DC Special number 29 from 1977, covering the secret origin of the JSA. So here, I'm talking about JSA in the 90s. On that podcast, I got to talk about JSA in the 70s. So check that out. And we had a fantastic time covering this legendary comic by Paul Levitz and Joe Staton. All right, for this episode, remember, find us on social media as JSA Presents. As I always say, it's about building a community of online JSA fans around the show. Now, I've collected your feedback from the last episode where we talked about JSA number 4 from 1991. I pulled the feedback from our website. I looked all over social media, emails, everywhere, and I put it all into one Google document, and it's pretty long. So what I'm going to do here is I am going to make sure to acknowledge everybody who left a comment on our website and read at least a piece of their feedback. So here we go. We'll start off with Rob McCarthy, author of the book The Star and the Space Princess and Other Stories. Now, we had talked about Zero Hour, I believe, during the In-Stock Trades pick, I think. And Rob commented there. He's like, Zero Hour? Didn't like the main series, but I bought every crossover. And you know, Rob, that's fair. I mean, Zero Hour is a interesting topic. In fact, our buddy Cisco did an entire podcast series covering every Zero Hour story, and there's a lot to love, and there's a lot to look at and go, they could have done better. So fair enough. Then we're from Comic Foil, and you may remember last episode we talked a little bit about comic creators who passed away too young. So Comic Foil chimed in with some of his. He says, two of my favorite artists who passed away too young would be Carlos Pacheco and Edwin Bicovic. I'm sure I said his last name wrong, so I apologize. So he says, Carlos Pacheco was a Spanish artist who catapulted himself into one of my all-time favorite artists drawing Avengers Forever with writer Kurt Busiek. He is, of course, has Justice Society ties, maybe most notably for drawing the JLA-JSA Virtue and Vice one-shot and covers to the ongoing JSA series. I was enjoying the heck out of his brilliant work on the creator-owned series Aerosmith, also with Kurt Busiek, and was heartbroken when I heard he passed away at age 60 in 2022. Comic Foil, I gotta tell you, Carlos Pacheco is amazing. What an incredible artist. In fact, you mentioned Avengers Forever. When I first started reading comics digitally, that was the very first comic I read in panel-by-panel mode, specifically because every single panel of Avengers Forever is gorgeous, is worthy of paying attention to. So if you have Marvel Unlimited, folks, or you have the digital version of Avengers Forever, read it in panel-by-panel mode. It is worth reading every single panel just from Carlos Pacheco's amazing artwork. All right, so Comic Foil continues. Edwin Bicovic, again, I said it wrong, I'm sure, passed away far too young at the age of 30. I can't recommend enough checking out any one of his works. His art was dynamic without being ostentatious, and his characters' faces were emotive to the point that words wouldn't even be necessary. A Croatian artist, I first saw his work at Dark Horse on Grendel Tales, Devils and Death, and its sequels, Devil Choice. He followed up with the best-looking Star Wars comic you'll ever get your hands on, X-Wing Rogue Squadron, The Phantom Affair. Whoa, Comic Foil, totally with you now. X-Wing Rogue Squadron, The Phantom Affair was gorgeous, you're right. All right, so Comic Foil continues. He says he then followed up with Star Wars The Last Command, an adaptation of the Timothy Zahn novel, also gorgeous, by the way, that shag. Then he says he made the jump to DC in 1999 for The Human Target with Peter Milligan, and published after his death was a short story, A Prayer to the Sun in Weird War Tales Vertigo Special with longtime writing partner Darko Macon. In my eyes, Bukovic was well on his way to becoming a superstar in the comic industry, a tragic loss at so young an age. Wow. Well, thank you for sharing that information. He was not even on my radar, even though I'd read some of those comics. Wow, what a loss. And he really is an exceptional artist. And the Comic Foil wraps up with saying, and David, your voice sounds great. You've got a tenor built for radio or podcasting. Yeah, I mean, J. David Weider, he is the real deal, man, when it comes to podcasting. No doubt. All right, moving on to Jose Rivera, author of The Underground Adventures. He says, great episode and great to hear from J. David Weider again. I was an avid listener of his New 52 Superman podcast back in the day, even when I wasn't loving the New 52 Superman books. But this issue, this was the one I was waiting for because this is my childhood. I got it in a grab bag from my local comic shop when I was a kid for $5. They gave you about 10 comics wrapped in a brown paper bag, so you didn't know what you'd get. It was probably a cheap way to get rid of some excess stock, but for a kid with little money, this was a great way to get it. some bang for your buck while exposing me to comics like the New Teen Titans, lots of Impact comics, and this issue of Justice Society, just to name a few. Well, this is the fourth issue in the series. I never had any trouble following along, and I love the image of Hawkman holding his shield and spear with a hatchet tucked into his belt. I'm happy to say I still have the issue, and it will forever hold a special place in my heart. When I look at the cover with Hawkman and Andromeda, it takes me back to being a kid and sitting on the floor of my room to be caught in the wonder of comics. Oh, that's lovely. Then Jose goes on to share regarding creators that have passed. Mark Gruenwald was Marvel for me as a kid. His run on Captain America and the U.S. Agent miniseries is my version of Cap. I'm the same age now as Mark Gruenwald was when he passed away, and that is mind-blowing. Yeah, you really feel your age when you hear these things, don't you, Jose? Ugh. He goes on to say, Dave Stevens. That hurt me when he passed away because I was such a Rocketeer fan thanks to the movie. I'd go to his comics where I could find them and fell in love with his art style. I wish he would have done some JSA stuff. I don't know why, but I can see him doing an amazing Hour Man, Dr. Midnight, or even Wildcat stories. Oh, totally agree with you there, Jose. He would have been ideal for those characters. Then he said, John Cassaday is still one I can't believe passed away. I'll always credit Starman as one of the reasons I wanted to get into writing, but Planetary was another. Cassaday's art is incredible throughout the series and is able to adapt to different styles based on the story. Well, thank you, Jose. Then we're from Mark Baker Wright from Black Rocks Toy Box and Not Your Father's Autobot podcast. He says, when this miniseries first came out, I hadn't been familiar enough with the JSA to actually know that the original Golden Age stories tended to have each member off on their own for the bulk of each story, only coming together at the end. That said, when it was explained to the early volumes of the miniseries that this was the pattern they were attempting to emulate, I understood. I'm not saying I wasn't disappointed. Sure, I wanted to see the whole team together as much as possible, but I understood what they were trying to accomplish, and I was okay with that. That the response at the time was any more heated than that, well, I can't honestly say that comes as a surprise, but I was unaware of the fact of it. And he says, I do tend to agree with J. David Weider that this is probably reads much better now, when you can binge all the parts together and enjoy the slow burn. I think that having to wait a full month between installments was probably just too hard to maintain the interest when fans didn't get what they were looking for out of the gate. That said, it must have still done well enough that they did bring the JSA back from limbo, even with the complainers out there. So it seems that it all worked out. Yeah, Mark, I mean, that's a great point. Even with all the complaining, it still launched that next ongoing series. So there we go. Then Super Captain chimed in. It says, Shag and Dave mentioned several regarding the creators who passed away too soon. Mentioned several, including the amazing Tim Sale. I would also highlight Mark Gruenwald, whose Captain America run is my favorite Marvel solo book from the 80s, and maybe ever. His style seemed like a perfect fit for DC, and it was a shame he'd never had the opportunity to play with that universe. I think he would have written a very good JSA book. Super Captain, I agree. I think he would have wrote any great DC book, although I really think his shining moment would have been in the Justice League, because I mean, he was so passionate about the Justice League that I think he would have done an amazing JLA book. So, Super Captain continues, I will add the name of Lee Motor, who passed away at the age of 53. I love his Legion art and most of all his contribution to the creation of Courtney Whitmore, aka Stargirl. I had no idea Lee Motor passed away. Wow, okay. Then he goes on to say, finally, great episode, Shag. And David, I'm trying to catch up quickly with the long walk through Nightfall on the Batpod. Awesome. Then we're from Bucky749, the American Samurai, who has his own YouTube channel. He says, this was a good episode. I've never read any Golden Age Hawkman. I've only read Hawkman when I read the times he teamed up with the Atom. Well, those are some good stories to enjoy, Bucky, so not so bad. Then we're here from Chris Franklin from the Firewater Podcast Network. He has shows such as the Mr. and Mrs. Superman right here on JSA Presents, as well as Batman Nightcast and more. He says, great show, fellas. I like Tom Artist's work here quite a bit. One unique thing about him that it really fits the JSA is his penchant for drawing slim-waisted heroes with thick belts and their pants pulled up to the abdomen. Similar to how artists like the young Carmen Infantino, Lee Elias, Alex Toth, Irwin Hasing, and those folks drew the JSA back in the later Golden Age tales. He seems to switch to a much looser, wilder style when he draws the web for Impact, and honestly, I didn't like it nearly as much. Then Chris says, I did think the format of the solo series, then small team-ups, and then a final team gathering was a bit odd, but I also knew it was based on the JSA stories of the Golden Age. For years, each hero had a solo chapter, and then they'd have a brief team-up at the story's end. Later, the writers began splitting them into teams of two, and then a big team-up at the end, which is the same format many JLA stories later followed. So this mini-series combines both approaches. In hindsight, I think it works, though despite contemporary audiences not getting it. Then Martin Gray from the Too Dangerous for Girl blog chimes in on that very topic. He says, the big difference is that the original series used that format within what we consider a giant 64-page issue. So you did get to see everyone every issue eventually, and maybe for only a few pages. I remember pulling a face at the format of this mini. So yeah, what he's saying is, you know, this format of having solo adventures and then groupings and then finally the full team at the end, what Martin is saying is, yes, that was the format, but they did it all in one issue. So that's a fair distinction, Martin. Then he goes on to say, cheers for another great episode, Shag and David. I love this cover so much. You're right, Shag. It's rare to see the full wingspan of a hawk person. By the way, did anyone ever buy the explanation that massive clunky wings aided direction? Come on, any human being would be a lot faster and zippier with the nth metal belt alone. Still, don't those wings look cool? Well, Martin, I gotta think that it helped them like bank and turn and things like that, but hey, it's comics. Then Martin says, the art of Tom Artis is so great with Frank McLaughlin. As Chris said, it looked very different on the web. I found that comic incredibly tough to follow. And then he says, William Wild Eagle was a striking fella. He had a real Wyatt Wingfoot energy, same initials too. But it did feel really weird that he didn't gain superpowers. Roy Thomas would have had him gain superpowers. Desert Stormer? Mesa Man? The possibilities were endless. Martin, you make a good point. They really did go out of their way to introduce this guy and tell us his history and everything, and then he just disappears halfway through the issue. So it would have made a lot more sense if he had been around. Maybe we'll see more of him. I don't know. I haven't read ahead in a long time. Then we're from Tim Price from the Outcasters Under Siege and Avengers podcast. Tim says, I love the artwork in this series quite a bit, which is a feat when having such different artists each issue. But man, Tom Artis' work this time really sings to me. I've seen other books by him, and I don't remember them leaving such an impression. Maybe Frank McLaughlin's inks are the key. Carter, both in civvies and costume, look great and elevates the whole issue. So much energy and movement, which you need for Hawkman, whose primary thing is flying. Then Tim shares something that didn't really work for him. He says, on page 5, when Carter's giving the big info dump, they use the exact same headshot, just tweaking the angle of the head once. But his mouth is clamped shut while he's supposedly talking, and no change in expression. That just looked odd enough to take me out of it. But just for a minute, because the rest of the story got back on track. Great episode, guys. Well, thanks, Tim. Then we heard from Jordan Jennings from Extremely Uncanny and host of the podcast Never Ending Battle. He says, great episode as always. On the topic of creators that left us far too soon, I want to echo mentions of Tim Sale, Darwin Cook, and John Cassaday. All three of those artists were major inspirations for my artwork. Each had a different approach to their work, but they all had something special. Cassaday's Astonishing X-Men was my re-entry back into comics, and I remember studying the way he was able to convey so much emotion with such minimal line work. Cook's New Frontier was just life-changing as a comic reader, and was, in a way, my first real exposure to a history of the DC Universe, albeit in a different lens. And Sale's work is just something else. Perfectly moody and expressive, which brings me to an interesting note. For those who love Superman for All Seasons and wanted a sequel, I recommend checking out Cook and Sale's Superman Kryptonite. It was published as Superman Confidential issues 1 through 5 and number 11. Cook is on writing duties and Sale manages to get away from Loeb for a few issues. It's a great follow-up and criminally slept on. One last thing about Cook, I started reading his Parker adaptations and they are easily some of the finest examples of comic work from someone who is already a titan of the industry. All three of their deaths were far too soon and all three hurt deeply. Jordan, I actually picked up one of the Parker adaptations for that very reason. I haven't had a chance to read it yet, but it's on my to-read shelf. Then we're from Lizanne Oswald, who has her own YouTube channel. Liz says, cool episode as always. Not a big fan of this version of the villain, but the artwork was nice and decent enough story. I look forward to the next episode. Well, thanks, Liz. Then we're from John Stibe, who says, I wish I had more to say than great episode, guys. But it was. I felt it was a bit of a downer to start with creators who left us much too early, but also a valid conversation point. When I was younger than I am today, I would just shrug and feel bad that an old person had passed away. Now, all that I can do is think that their age at their passing in relation to my own. It's a tough pill to swallow sometimes. Here I go, getting maudlin too. Suffice to say that these creators' works will live on long after them. The JSA has been about legacy for so long now, it's fitting that comics about them are also someone's legacy. Well, that's a deep thought, John. Thanks for sharing that. Then we heard from Dan Greenfield from the 13th Dimension website. He says, I picked up this series just yesterday, $1 a piece. That's a great buy, Dan. I hope you enjoy them. Heard from Craig McDee, who says, this issue is my introduction to the Golden Age Hawkman. It was my first JSA comic, and a couple issues later, I'd be introduced to the Golden Age Black Canary. Awesome, Craig. And then Robert Junker says, you asked about creators who passed away too early. Here's a couple of mine. John Cassaday, loved his art style, and his work on Planetary is phenomenal. Peter David, always my go-to for when I wanted a laugh, but he could also do serious and compelling like a few others. From Spider-Man to Star Trek to actually making the Hulk interesting, the comics world became a slightly smaller place when he passed away. You're not wrong, Robert. Peter David was a titan of comic books and superhero comics and, quite frankly, Star Trek prose fiction. I have an entire shelf dedicated to Peter David, New Frontier, Star Trek novels. And I love that series. Absolutely love it from top to bottom. And it's very sad that knowing that he's not with us anymore. Okay, well, now is the part of the show where I thank everyone who shared our show on their social media, which is Facebook, Blue Sky, Instagram, Twitter, or X, and Threads. It is a long list of names. However, I know that, right? I do this every month, and you guys sit through this, and I appreciate it. However, these folks, they showed their support, and they promoted the show. So it's important to me that we recognize these individuals. This time out, we got over 80 people who helped promote the last episode of the show. And there's actually probably more, because Facebook and Instagram are being a royal pain. I've been telling you about this for a while. It's not getting any better. So I can't see who actually reshared there anymore. anymore. So I've been collecting the information from my notifications, and that can be pretty hit or miss. Especially if someone shared it and they have privacy settings on their Facebook, then you can't see it. So anyway, I did my best. If I missed you, I am really, really sorry. And you could be on this list next month. It's very easy just by sharing or retweeting or reskeeting or whatever it's called on Facebook, Blue Sky, Instagram, Extra Twitter, and Threads. So our thanks go out to Al the Comics Guy, Alan Williams, Alan Boyce Jr., Andre Freitas, Anthony Cardino, Bailey Planet, Barry Reese's Infinity Ink Tumblr, Benjamin Hall, Between the Pages Blog, Bill Beer, Billy D and his accounts for Magazines and Monsters, and A World on Fire, an All-Star Squadron podcast, Brad Dade, Brian Schufo, Chris Franklin, Chris Mort, Chris Retz, Clinton Robison, Comic Foil, Craig McD, D. Kennedy at Detective 38, Dan Dougherty, Dave Tomko and his account for DC New Earth 2, Dave's Comics Heroes Blog, David Ace Gutierrez, DC Dave, Derek Crabb, Dr. Chris Lewis, Dr. Pop Culture, Ed Moore, Eli Knight 201, Extremely Jordan, Gentleman Joey, Hither Came Conan, J. David Weider, John Stibe, John Vincent Palomo, J.P. Roca, Justice Trek, Justin Steiner, Keechee Baker, Lizanne Oswald, Mark Baker Wright, Martin Gray, Matthew Barton, Melissa Bice, Michael Kramer, Mike Jameson and his accounts for Pop Culture Basement and Sleazebag Cinema, Mike Thomas, Mo Walker, Nino Brown, not a Doombot. I mean, but really, isn't that exactly what a Doombot would say? Not a Doombot? Very sus. All right, Otaku Mike, Paul Kian, Pedro Angosto, Prairie Justice, the Greg Saunders Vigilante Podcast, Kutari Ninja Warrior, Randy Caldwell, Richard Field, Robert Junker, Ryan Daly and his Batman Nightcast account, Samson 1628, Scott X, Sean Ross and his Peacebound and Down, a Wonder Woman podcast account, Silverman on Security, S. Matthew Stolte, The Burning Cosmic, The Comic Book Clutch, The Earth 2 Podcast, The Only American Captain Britain Fan, The Telltale Mind, Tim Price and his account for Outcasters, Under Siege, and Avengers Podcast, Venkman, Watch This Space, Willie Yarbrough, Zach Crum, and Zek Cap Boots. So my thanks to all of you for your support of the JSA in the 90s podcast. Your feedback has been such a critical part of the show. And this community of JSA fans we're building together is absolutely fantastic. Now, if I've forgotten or missed anyone, I am terribly sorry. It is probably the fault of J. David Weider. I do my best, as I said, to find all the social media comments, but sometimes they do slip through my internet fingers. So if I missed you, just drop me a note and I'll be sure to include you in the next episode. And keep those cards and letters coming, folks. The best place is to visit our website, which is fireandwaterpodcast.com/JSA. Leave your comments on the show post there, and fellow JSA fans can share their thoughts and you all can communicate together. You can also find us on most social media platforms as JSA Presents, including Facebook, Blue Sky, Instagram, Twitter or X, and Threads. Or you can email us at justicesocietypresents@gmail.com. Again, thank you folks so much for an amazing collection of feedback. Now, we're going to take a quick podcast promo break. And when we come back, we're going to connect with this episode's guest, Ranger Gord, and we'll see how he managed wrangling the horses.
Between the Golden Age of Atlantis and the rise of recorded history, there were ages undreamed of. Hither came heroes and villains possessing swords and magic, whose deeds became tales and legends. I have come to relate these sagas. Let me tell you of the days of high adventure. Days of High Adventure, a new podcast discussing a variety of comics that fall into the fantasy or sword and sorcery genre. Available on most podcast services and Anchor FM.
Professor Zoom Yukinori led an ongoing expedition through his favorite single-issue comic book stories from the Bronze Age of DC Comics. With unique celebrity guest perspectives to set this program apart from other comic book review podcasts.
Solomon Grundy, don't understand.
Entity Terra Man.
I'm not following either.
Bizarro, totally get it.
I intend to participate in your podcast show of wonders.
As if I wasn't nervous enough.
Little Professor Man, mansplaining again.
Accessing files.
Experience the wonder.
Bizarro, what in tarnation did you do?
Adios, partner. I am Bizarro Terra Man.
Goodbye,
of the Done in One Wonders Podcast Wonder Show.
Watch out, you square brain varmint.
Only on the Fire and Water Podcast Network.
Okay, folks, we're back from break, and yes, we've got Ranger Gord back with us. Now, Gord, thank you so much for appearing on this episode. Thank you for suggesting this as a Patreon suggestion. That's fantastic. Now, I would like you to tell people where they can find you on the internet, and I'm sure you're going to tell us to listen to the
Prairie Justice, the Greg Saunders Vigilante Podcast.
Yeah, we did that perfectly in sync.
I'm certain we did. Yes. Well, yes. The Prairie Justice Podcast is, of course, an index show where I have started in the 1940s, going in mostly chronological continuity order of the Vigilante's adventures. Now, I don't know how far I've gotten, but I'm also doing the Seven Soldiers of Victory appearances as well. So that slows me down a little bit. We're into about 1943. So it'll be a while before I get to this book. But in continuity, it'll be there before you know it, because 47 is a very busy year for Vigilante with the serial and all. But that's what we do. And I perform it as a radio show. I do pretty much all of the voices, sound effects, and such. I would love to put more music into it, but there is that copyright thing. So I'm a little bit careful how I do that. I used to have a nice segment called Greg Saunders Ranch Radio. And I said, well, if he's a singer, you know, I should have music on it. Well, I do what I can. I try to use the music of friends or people I know, or people who I know won't track me down, you know, on their gas-beaten bronc. And I put a little bit of that into, but mostly I'm sticking with the radio drama. That is the center of it. Meskin and Samuelson and, even go back to Mort Weisinger, were very good in how they did this, how they set it up. Golden Age stories loved text boxes, which is something that's missing from this book. Like they had their own narrator. So I become my own narrator, and I do the other voices along with it. It's getting better. I think Stuff is just a cool character. I don't think the Chinatown Kid is a slur at all, because this is not Chop Chop. This is not Wing. He is a very resourceful Chinese American kid who gets the job done. Sometimes he gets the job started, but that's sort of just the fun of it. I believe they do. They have done, for the Golden Age, I think they have done a really good job with Stuff, minus the unfortunate coloring. But the palette is what the palette is in those times. And I'm a fan of the Golden Age. I think the Golden Age is so primal. This is where we got our heroes from. Dr. Fate came out of that age, you know, just to play with the host's mind here. And the reason we love Dr. Fate so much is just that primal instinct of what they put into that. They didn't flesh the character out too much. They left just enough room for us to figure it out. And the idea of the Justice Society is history as it's being made. They're literally during World War II. Kids are reading about the horrors and the headlines and the battles in the headlines and listening to it on the radio as they're picking these comics up and watching their heroes fight it. So I just think that, you know, that was probably such a secret weapon that I just love how Roy Thomas has structured it over the years. It's too bad we've gotten so far away from that. I would love to see the return of an all-star squadron, you know, set during those times and doing such a good job of trying to stitch together the continuity. I'm not a continuity wonk, but it's fun when you have a universe and you can build it. And, you know, you can pick and choose. You can cherry pick. Anyway, that's what Prairie Justice is. It's my kind of my love letter to the Golden Age and my own little particular V-lister portion of it.
Well, it's a lot of fun. And folks, you've got to seek out the podcast. Once again, it's Prairie Justice, the Greg Saunders Vigilante Podcast. So find that. And really, Gord has poured his heart and soul into it. And it's a great listen. So be sure to check it out.
I'd like to say it's more regular, but I have a job still, and the job gets bigger and bigger all the time. So you'll get it when you get it.
Exactly. Hey, podcasting's supposed to be fun. We're doing this for fun. So absolutely. And thank you again, Ranger Gord, for being here. I really appreciate it.
Well, that's okay. Well, I hope you don't mind that I got a little stuff on my boots when I was out there feeding Dobbin. Do you want me to clean that up first?
It's all perfectly fine. No worries there, partner.
Okay.
Well, that's going to do it, folks. Now, come back next episode when we cover Justice Society of America number 5, and I'll be joined by a fantastic guest to help me cover the issue. Who will it be? Come on, people. You know how this works. You're just going to have to wait and find out next episode. Thanks for listening, everyone. Until next time, I'm Shag.
And I'm Ranger Gord.
And we're asking you to join the fight.
For justice, partners.